You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
Who dressed me up like this? Am I really Batman? Did I go to a Phantom of the Opera concert?
That sounds like something I want to attend next year.
Yeah, or is this some weird Eyes Wide Shut party I don't know about? Like, this could get go a lot of ways.
Get ready for the social hour.
Live from Dee's World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is the Social Hour. On today's show, comic book creator David Sutton. And now your host. Facebook has announced they won't be fact-checking anymore, but he still knows you're all full of shit. Dees Casillas.
Malib Keen, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Dees. Thanks for coming back. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas, Hanukkah, and all that, whatever you celebrate. Hopefully you had a good one. Hopefully you had a good new year. Welcome to the first episode of The Social Hour of 2025. Back on track. We took a little holiday vacation, and I know everyone needed it. A little holiday hangover. It felt like a long but short 2024. We have a 2025 kicking off. Lots of exciting stuff. It's going to be a good year. I feel like we have a lot of entertainment just in the world and what's happening today already. But we're going to get right into it today, guys. No announcements off the top. Oh, wait. Sorry. One announcement. As always, go to deescomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network. Live shows. No shows for January. I'm taking it easy. I'm working on another project. February, hitting the ground running with a bunch of dates. So check that out. And also go to inferno.earth for the comic book Killstand. We've got the Kickstarter for number 2 is launching soon. The pre-launch page is up. Follow that. We've got some variants in. Check those out. But if you follow me on social media, you're getting a shameful, compacted ass load of that I plug every day. So you know where to go. Speaking of comic books, we are going to get into it with our guest today. Welcome to the show, the creator, writer, and artist of Ravenous, David Sutton. David, how you doing?
Pretty good, man. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for being here. I've told David before we start, I've got a puppy that we've adopted, and she's can't decide whether she wants to sleep or not. You know puppies. So, thanks for being here. David, we met at a convention in Dallas a couple months ago. He's a fellow indie creator, had a killer book there that he was moving and a series he's working on that we are going to talk about shortly. Before that, let's just get to know David. David, you live in Austin, Texas now. You're from Michigan originally, is that right?
Yes, Detroit, Michigan, yeah, originally.
What got you from Detroit to Austin, Texas?
Oh, wow. well, my last two years of high school, before my last 2 years of high school, I moved to Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay.
And after graduation, I joined the military. I joined the U.S. Navy. And from there, I've been almost all over the world. I retired out of the Navy in 2009. And my last station was in San Diego, California. Okay. And I had been in San Diego for almost 14 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And California just wasn't working anymore, so we left.
yeah, that's I get that. someone from California. I concur. California is not working anymore on nearly any level, spiritually, cosmically.
All the way around. And 2017, we left. We were just like, hey, this is not good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They the state, sorry, California, but, the state got ruined.
Yeah.
But,
they've got, the bureaucracy there is not doing a great job of, keeping that state up. That's for sure.
Yeah. Not friendly to small business at all, so we picked Austin, Texas, and, we've been here, ever since, almost seven years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting time you said you moved from 2014 is when you moved from San Diego to Austin, you said, or
2017, November of 2017.
And
yeah.
Okay. You lived there for 14 years. So early 2000s. Yeah. That's a long, I used to, I'm from LA and I had cousins who lived in San Diego and I spent a lot of time down there. And there was a time when I would have told you I wanted to live in San Diego and I loved it there, but man, mm-hmm. I mean, you guys being boots on the ground must've just seen that change in the city of what it was and what it became, it always had a little bit of a homeless problem, but it was more, it was like a fun beach homeless, it wasn't like a methed out machete guy homeless that they have kind of thing going on now, it was like the fun old guy drinking Boone's Farm at the beach being like, I was going to be an actor. And you're like, yeah, sure.
Exactly.
You're right, buddy.
That all changed. There were considerably, more mentally ill on the streets.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a problem. And also, I think around that time, fentanyl was hitting the streets.
Ooh, yeah.
And it was before it was the buzzword. Yeah. So yeah, that changed a lot. Yeah.
Well, it's right across the border, San Antonio, San Diego's like the beta testing. To see if it was going to work. If it works in San Diego, it'll work anywhere. And now it does work everywhere. The downtown San Diego, the Gaslamp Quarter and stuff, I mean, just beautiful. I used to love going down there and having a good time. I mean, it's just beautiful area, beautiful people, beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything about it was nice. It just got kind of dicey, kind of fast.
Yeah, it got dicey real fast, and a lot of businesses started to close. They couldn't sustain. Not a lot of people had disposable income.
Yeah.
So, like, even big anchor stores and everything, a lot of places have closed down. It was crazy. The contrast. The malls started to get emptier and emptier because no one could spend. So when we came to Austin, the malls were packed. It was like, oh yeah, this is what I remember.
It's like 1999 all over again.
Yeah,
it's funny when places, because I went through this when we left Washington and moved down to Texas a few years ago. It was the same thing where you're looking at it being like, this place is getting shittier and more expensive. How does that work out? Like, it doesn't, like this, like, how is my property value going down, but I'm paying more? What is happening right now? This is it doesn't make any sense.
That's exactly it. It's like, Gotta go. Yeah. Gotta go.
Yeah, it's. I always said that California is like that girl who was hot, who like peaked at sophomore year in high school, you know?
That's exactly it. And
you know, she still thinks she's that sophomore in high school, but now she's, you know, 45 with two kids from different dads, smoking Virginia Slims and drinking boxed wine after her, you know, part-time job at Walmart. You're like, lady, you got to get it. You're not the cheerleading squad leader anymore, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly it. My friends are like, "What about the beach? And what are you going to do? Why are you going to leave?" And I said, "Well, when's the last time you've been to the beach?"
Yeah. Yep.
I said, "Your tan isn't looking so great because you're working all the time."
Yeah.
You know,
just to survive.
I said, what sense does it make if you make $90K a year and you have to get a part-time job as a server?
Yeah, right.
That's insane to me. Yeah. You tell that to anyone else in the country. You make $90K, you have a master's degree, but you have to get a part-time job as a server.
Yeah, but you can't afford. You got to move. Yeah, you're living out in Pacoima and driving 2.5 hours to
right.
LA.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're renting a room. You don't even own your own home.
Right.
That's insane. Or you're working three jobs. I knew people that are working 3 to 4 jobs.
Oh, yeah.
They go from one job to another, to another, to another, to another.
Yeah.
I was like, this isn't living, man. This is just surviving. I was like, back to the guy. He said, what about the beach? He's like, oh, yeah, that's right. And I was like, yeah, I could move somewhere affordable and fly.
Right, yeah. I can afford a beach vacation every year, right? You know? It is. It's a weird gilded cage that people in California get into, where they just work to survive, to live there because they want to live there, but they don't get to enjoy any of the things that are actually there to enjoy, which are fewer and fewer every day, I would say.
Yep.
But you know, it's like, oh, do you want to go in the polluted ocean or the one in, do you want to go to Venice Beach where, you know, you're getting attacked by homeless people, or which beach do you want to go to?
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird gilded cage they get in to, it's where they're paying to survive there, but they don't get to actually enjoy any of it. I mean, I always said, like, I grew up in Long Beach, and like, I love Long Beach as a city. I liked living there. There were things about it. Cause like, you didn't really have to go to LA proper to, and you could, everything. Long Beach is a huge city, right?
Right.
But I'm like, I don't want to pay every dime I make to live here. I mean, the only way in, I say this hypothetically, I never, probably realistically never would, but I'm like, the only way I would ever want to live there again is if I was making, you know, $500,000 a year and could, you know, live, didn't have to drive in traffic every day and didn't have to, you know, was out of that rat race of like, I got to do this and I need money, just like comfortable room, et cetera.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But with that, I was like, well, even if I made $500,000 a year, they're going to tax the shit out of me.
Right, I'm coming home with two.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when I move out of state, because I'm so pissed, they're going to still tax me for 3 years after I move. You hear about this
exactly.
Shit? They're trying to tax
the millionaire
people.
Tax.
Yeah, yeah, like you move out, we're still taxing. I'm like, get the fuck out. Yeah, I'm, yeah. It's like, I don't live here. You know, I don't know you anymore. Tax me. Yeah. Get the hell out of here.
Hey, that's what happens when you elect a used car salesman as a governor.
Oh my god. Out of control.
Yeah, I wish them luck though.
Better luck. Yeah, you're gonna need another roommate soon, but I know guys my age. I mean, I'm 42. I know guys, like friends I grew up with, who are still living with their parents. Never moved out because they just can't afford it, or they live
can't
in you know, there's five guys do a two-bedroom house or something. I'm like, man, you guys are adults. You need to fucking...
Right,
you gotta
right, yeah.
Figure it out.
Imagine explaining that to a date.
Oh, my God, too. Yeah.
That is not a discussion that I want to have. Well, oh, nice to meet you, David.
Yeah.
Well, how old are you? Okay, 42. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, yeah. So where do you live? With my mom.
Yeah. She. Yeah. I like to think she lives with me, right. But technically it's her house. You know, she, Yeah. It hit me when I finally moved in like 08, 09. It was right after the financial crisis of 08, and it was so bad down there. And I'm like, you know what? I gotta get out of here. Cause I was looking around at places, and this guy was literally renting out a part of his apartment that he had like ramshackle made a curtain around where you would like, and I'm like, I'm gonna rent a part of it. I'm like, this ain't happening, man. This is insane. I'm like, I'm out. I'm leaving. This is crazy. I'm not gonna rent I'm not gonna be the guy behind a curtain, like the fucking some voyeur Wizard of Oz. If he brings a date over or something, like, hey, what's, you know, get out of here. I'm moving to another state. Yeah. I don't need this shit. I'm an adult.
Exactly.
And I mean, I got a cousin down in North Orange County, and he bought a house a while back, and you know, it's not Orange County like the Hills, Orange County. It's nice. It's not the best. Not like Newport Beach, but it's, you know, Tustin, nice little bedroom community. And this house over $1 million he paid for this thing, and I went there and looked at him like, it's $1 million house. Like, this is a 2 bedrooms. What do you think?
Exactly.
I mean, it's nice, yeah. But I mean, oof, gosh.
Hey, man, I hear you, but it's that it. That's one of the other things that didn't make sense to me, having been and lived in different parts of the country.
Yeah,
and visiting other countries, it's like, man, $1 million. This is not worth it.
No.
It's not worth it. I was like, man, and that was the thing in San Diego. The same thing, $750K for a shit shack. It's just like, you know,
what are we doing? What are we? It's it makes no sense. I mean, you know, you think about as a kid, you know, you think about a mansion or like a million dollar house, and you think about. I mean, you think about like Buckingham Palace, right? You're thinking like you're going to get this palatial estate with you know. But no, it's 2,500 square foot.
You have to pay taxes on that.
Oh.
And you can't lose your job.
Yeah.
You can't. Even if you pay the house off, you can't lose your job. You have to pay taxes on that.
Yeah.
A house that's assessed at $1 million. I was like, no.
Good luck.
That's no good.
Well, and that's part of that gilded cage I think these people get in is they get afraid to move out of California. Like, well, I could sell this house and I could buy a house somewhere else cheaper. But here's the thing. I can never afford to move back. So, like, you know, so if they're there, they're like, we're still here. We're scraping by. But because if they leave, there's no coming back. Like, you're never going to be able to afford to get back into a house.
Exactly.
So we found Texas too, and we're like, we're good,
right?
Like, it's
unless you move to Fresno, but
yeah.
Or Victorville.
Yeah, now we're talking, speaking of fentanyl, Oh my God!
Sorry, Victorville. Sorry,
I'm not. Those places suck. I stand by my statement. the Social Hour podcast would like to say we do not endorse Victorville or Fresno as places anyone should live or claim to be from. If you're there now, move.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's a good old Central Valley, California. It's real. Oh boy.
Oh yeah. Not all of it looks like Beverly Hills.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Ain't that the truth? So what? How did you guys decide on Austin from San Diego?
One of the main things is that it's a young city.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
And the population is young. That was appealing to both of us, especially me, being in the military for so long. I would, you know, meet each new generation, or, you know, I was constantly around young people, and that keeps you on your toes.
Yeah.
Keeps your mind young. You know, you don't, you stay flexible.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, you know who Dua Lipa is. You know, you start to figure, you know, you gotta be up. You gotta know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, that was one of the reasons. You know, the cost of living, obviously. And, you know, this seemed like a pretty cool city. It's technically a little bit bigger than San Diego in square miles, just a tiny bit. Population, not so much, but, you know, they're close. But it's really cool.
Yeah,
really cool.
Yeah, Austin's a especially in Texas, a unique city. But yeah, I here in San Antonio, I like being close to it so I can go up there. But it's. As being from LA, it's a little busy. I like the traffic in San Antonio better than Austin. It's a little less trafficy. So,
I agree with you 100%. The traffic in San Antonio is a lot better than Austin all day. A little bit better drivers too. Sorry, guys. But yeah, that's
better than San Antonio. Damn, Austin's got to be bad then.
Yeah.
I've always said I thought San Antonio had bad drivers because it's such a military city that I feel like it's so transient that it does, you know, every city has like, this is how Seattle drives or Portland or
right.
Whereas like everyone is from somewhere else. Everyone's from somewhere else or they're illegal. So like add all those types of driving together and it's like a shit show. So, you know.
Yeah. 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 It's some wild stuff up here as well. These, and it's smaller.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Gets congested faster.
Does
this happen in Austin? I have this pet peeve with San Antonio drivers, and I noticed this the first, literally as soon as I moved here. If a car is in at a light, and they're in the left turn lane, if it goes to like a blinking yellow where you yield to oncoming traffic, they never pull out into the intersection before they turn. They stay behind the crosswalk instead of pulling out into the intersection. So like, I'm like, just go. You can pull out. You can, like, three of us can go in the time one of you go. If you would just pull out into the intersection a little bit.
I hate to break it to you, man, but here in Austin, they have a problem with the four-way stop.
Oh, I believe that's too complicated for them. They just hand out Velcro shoes to everyone.
Wow. It's like, hey, guy, you got to your stop sign first, so it's your turn.
They don't know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the move. Here's the move, David. What I do is every time I'm rolling up to a four-way stop, I break out my white gloves and traffic cop hat, and I start pointing. I will literally point at a driver if they're there first. I go, and I'm like, go. I'm pointing and I'm telling people, I'm like, this is it. And because if you do the nice wave, then they wave back and you get in this weird, like, nice off. I'm like, none of that shit. Point at you. You go that way. And then they just they'll take the direction.
So what you were asking before, that's a little too complex, Deez. That's
it gets them moving, I'm telling you, every time.
Yeah.
Oh, see if that, yeah, you can try that next time you get to that stop sign. Do a little, be assertive, and you that way. And now, you know.
Yeah, I started flashing my high beams to him. Like, hey, you go. Come on.
Moving on.
Moving on. Yeah.
Yeah. So with the, growing up then, were you always a comic book guy? I mean, you do comic books now. Is it something you loved, or did you just find the medium later?
I grew up as a comic book guy. Yeah. I love comics. You know, I guess started at four.
Yeah.
4 years old. So I've always loved the medium. So I think somewhere around maybe 12 or 13, I knew I wanted to make some, you know, I'd make my little characters and stuff like that. But yeah, I've always been a comic book guy.
What was early on, what was your bread and butter? What was your favorites?
Spider-Man, Superman, the usual suspects.
Yeah.
Batman, Teen Titans, X-Men, you know, the mainstream stuff. By the time I was a teen, I started to notice the indie comics, you know, but before that, I'd say by the time I reached age 12, there was a disconnect with the usual suspects.
Yeah.
You know, how they were written, I get it, but
it was missing. There's a little je ne sais quoi that was little.
Something was missing, and it was frustrating. You know, you're from the big city. We're both from big cities. Detroit isn't as big anymore, but you start to see things, you start to notice things, and you're like, well, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
People don't actually behave this way. And how could hero, you know, let's say Batman, how can he move in the city if Gotham is worse than New York, Detroit, LA, Chicago? How is he operating with this attitude?
Yeah.
Right? It just seemed disingenuous.
Right.
And as a, you know, it was frustrating. That's when I started to make my own characters. But as a teen, I think around 17, I started to pick up indie books.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, they get it.
Yeah, you can do this.
You can do this. Yeah, you don't have to, follow the same template as these guys.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that was an eye opener, you know. But I wanted to do that anyway. But to see, you know, someone actually making it, you know, beforehand, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it kind of validates your ideas, you know, of how you think things can be done. Do you remember the first comic book that gave you like this, like that started to plug you into that idea? Because, you know, same as you. I mean, I read all that stuff growing up, and then, you know, you get older, and you're able to process things a little bit differently, and you look at things differently, and you can understand subtext better and nuance. And then you know, you're looking for that. And then, you know, a comic book comes along and you're like, oh, this isn't just villain of the week. This is more than that. You know, do you remember what that was? What book that was for you?
The first one was a book called Badger.
Okay, I'm from First Comics, right? Weren't they from First Comics?
Yeah,
yep, yeah. I remember yeah. Badger.
Mm-hmm. Badger, yep. And the OG Turtles.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was hardcore. They weren't the Nickelodeon version.
Yeah, it wasn't the Saturday morning cartoon version yet.
Yeah, not at all. But Badger from First Comics, that one, wow. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot different. I was like,
okay. That reminds me of a couple... a while back, I was looking for some a trade paperback, and I was looking for collected editions of the early Ninja Turtles, right? To see if I was, and they've done a lot of different ones over the years, and I was trying to find one that was remastered in color, like a specific one, right?
Right.
And I'm looking and looking. I'm on Amazon, and some lady left a review of. Gave one of them a 1-star review because she's like, this book is, I bought this for my kid and it's too violent and adult themed, you know, they should warn people this and that. And I'm like, I don't think you can give it a 1-star because you didn't read the fucking content, lady. Like, no, you know, like that's not a one. Like, it didn't come ripped in half. It didn't come with like racial slurs in it. Like, it just came as it was created. You just didn't do your research, and now you're mad. Like,
yeah, that's the other thing, man. That Turtles book and Badger, it was like, yeah, man, you know, there are people out there that accept it.
Yeah.
And they're doing well. Because like I said, by the time I got to 12, you know, I was like, man, why is the Joker still alive?
Right. Yeah, just what are we doing, Batman? This is almost your fault now.
Yeah, you know, and it's you know, and it's one of those things. It's like, if Batman doesn't do it, then the cops would certainly shoot this dude on sight.
Yeah, yeah, he hasn't gotten the death penalty yet. How fucking liberal is New York with their right. with their penal codes? They're right. like, no, the guy that tried to poison the water system again exactly. is just going to go on probation.
He's a mass murderer. I'm just like, come on, man. It's just like, no.
Yeah.
So that just didn't make any sense to me. I was like, man, you could at least break his legs, man.
Something. Something. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, man. But that was one of the perspectives. That kind of things just didn't make sense, and the no kill rule, that shit just didn't sit right with me.
Yeah,
I was just like, no, man, this is what.
Yeah.
So when I would draw comics on copy paper as a kid, and I would show them to my friends. And that was the first taste of finding out what works and what doesn't.
Your little focus group.
Yeah. And so, and what type of characters that hit, and I found out which ones that didn't. But there was one that was consistently strong no matter where I went, no matter who I showed it to. It was Ravenous.
Uh-huh.
He always stood out. Always stood out. But with that, as a 12-year-old I guess as a 12-year-old, you know, I was very immature. I wasn't what's his name, Jim Shooter.
Yeah,
you know, he was writing professional comic books at what, 14?
Yeah.
So you know, he was unreasonably violent. There was no reason. You know, it's just like all the stuff you want to do as a kid.
Right.
You don't think about the why. You don't think about any of that stuff. You just don't, you know. But I would say for Jim Shooter, his love of comic books, he followed that template. I didn't want to follow that template.
Yeah.
Of Spidey and Superman and Batman and all those guys. So it was, it took a while, Deez.
Yeah.
It took a while.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because again, you know, it's figuring out, A, that it's allowed, and then figuring out how, especially at a young age, to kind of mold that voice. But yeah, I mean, I get it. You know, when I was, I think one of the turning points for me was, reading The Max.
Oh, that's a good book.
Like that's one where I was like, this is weird. I remember reading it early and I'm like, this is weird. I don't 100% know what's going on, but I know I like this. And then like reading it and then rereading it and really like digging into the subtext as a whole when I had it, like I got the whole trade paperback collection here now that I've had for years, and rereading it that way, like all at once, and just being like, oh, like this is about mental illness and trauma. This is about PTSD. This is about, you know, the thing, like, the, you know, schizophrenia and the things we do to hide from reality when we can't, you know, and like, oh my God. And it's like, no wonder it was such a weird fringe book at Image, because Image is doing, you know, Rob Liefeld books in the mid 90s. Yep. And then you're like, and then we also have this, you know, people like didn't know what to do with it at the time. But stuff like that really changed the way you look at something. And it's one of the things I love about comic books. And I'm sure you can speak to this too. And that, you know, that I introduced my girlfriend to with comic books is that like, you can tell any story in this medium. Like people mm-hmm. think of it, people misconstrue comic books as superheroes. And they're like, no, that's a mm-hmm. genre. Granted, it's probably the largest genre in comics by mm-hmm. a extreme number, but it's definitely not the only one. And it's arguably the least interesting for the most part. And part of that is just because so much of it's done, you know, by sheer numbers, it's going to statistically be the least interesting, but when done right, it's also done very well. So it's, you know, you can tell any story in comic books you want to. It can be, horror, war, just a story about people's relationships. I mean, there's nothing that you have to, there's no constraints, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be surprised that A History of Violence was a graphic novel. The Road to Perdition was also a graphic novel. There are so many films that slip under the radar. They started as graphic novels and comics. So, that was the other thing too, Deez. I would find that a lot of great comics were so well written. They were written a lot better than what I was getting from TV.
Oh yeah,
and movies even. So yeah, they comics get sold short.
Yeah.
And that aspect.
It's a very disrespected medium as far as, because people, it's dismissed as like children read comic books, you know, which is true, but it's not exclusive. And when you're, you know, there's a mountain of extremely talented creators and writers. I mean, you even look at like what Chris Claremont did with his time on the X-Men. And you're like,
great stuff.
Like some of the character development and the arcs these people go through and the pathos is like masterfully done and really, really, I mean, and done in a way where like, it's part of, that was my thing growing up was X-Men. And it's part of why I love it so much is that these were characters that had real character traits that that affected their decisions. And when something would happen, you're like, oh yeah, that's how Aurora would react because of that. This.
Exactly. You know, my favorite Chris Claremont story I read when I was a kid was, I believe the title was God Loves, Man Kills.
Yeah.
I was blown away by that. You know, it's such a great story. It accomplished one of the things that was missing, you know, when I read comics around that time as a kid, you know, 12, 13.
Yeah.
I was like, man, this Chris Claremont, he gets it. You know, because they behave like people.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was the one with Stryker's kid was a mutant.
Yep.
And just so many human elements. And I was like, this is it.
Yep.
Yeah. But it was something that I remember when I started to develop Ravenous in this world. It's like, no matter how fantastical the powers or the situations, they have to react like a real person would react.
Right.
In their perspective situation. Right. Because I know a baker would react differently in certain situations than a cop, a doctor, or a police officer or a military, you know, a military person. So I always keep that in mind. So.
Yeah, I mean, that is what is like, for me, the benchmark of a good comic and good writing is when the interesting part is, the least interesting part, I will say, is like the fight scene. That's like skip. Because like, who gives a shit? Let me guess, the good guy's going to win. But what happens between that? What's the development of this person who's stuck in this extreme situation? You know, that's the juicy... That's the part I'm interested in. That's the easiest part to connect to, you know, because that's the real person.
Yeah. And I, you know, Deese, that's the tricky part with mainstream comics. If not so much with the X-Men or a majority of Marvel comic books, but when you get to Superman and Batman, if a writer tries to write a complex situation with them which is good writing is you put a character in a tough position where he or she is damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Yeah.
Right? There's no easy choice. And most are the belief of, well, you can't do that with Superman. So a lot of his stories are not as interesting. And it caused a lot of divisiveness and Man of Steel, where David Goyer, and I believe it was Chris Nolan who wrote that film, where he broke General Zod's neck when he was about to burn a family of four. It's like, well, what is he supposed to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And they say, well, he should have flew up in the air and flew him to the moon and all this. It's disingenuous. He told him, I will not stop killing these people as long as I'm around. I am going to kill everybody. And that, for a lot of comic book guys who worship that genre of comics, they're like, you should never put Superman in that position.
Yeah.
But caught between a rock and a hard place. And you know, that's but it's acceptable for Wolverine.
Right.
It's acceptable for Cyclops, for everyone else. But when you get to those, absolutely
you can't
not.
Do it.
Can't
yeah.
do it.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's, I think that's part of why those books suffer. Because, you know, it's like Superman is good. He's altruistic. He's always good. He will always do good. It's like, yeah, then why do I need to read this book? You know?
Right.
Where's the emotional connection when it's only good? There is no struggle of consciousness or no struggle of, yeah, of consciousness, of inner turmoil, because it's all, the answer is always the high road. So.
Right. But that's the thing. It's we're not asking for anyone to write Superman like the Punisher.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, so here's a person who is just as powerful as he is. He's not a human being. If you say he doesn't kill humans, that's great. He's punching down.
Yeah.
I get that. But with a threat like that, it's like,
yeah, you gotta figure some wiggle room here.
Yeah. So so as a kid, that was a problem I had with you know, and I love Superman. I just want to make that clear. I love Superman.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll always love that character. But there are some things that are disconnect, and I think the character is needed. People need something to aspire to that's a little bit better. He's a character that's not supposed to be relatable to. It's something you aspire to.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Which, you know. But at the same time, I think the writers could do a little better.
Yeah. They can always do a little better.
It's just a little better.
I'll try to be magnanimous here, and I will admit, I do think that it's not always necessarily, I think the writers might be constrained by editorial oversight at times. So there have been great writers that maybe could not do as good as they wanted to, because, you know,
that's fair.
Warner Brothers as a multinational conglomerate
right.
is only going to let you do so much with their IP.
Right. But at the same time, folks won't accept it. His core fans, they won't accept it. And you know, that's fine. But for me, as a writer, it's like, If I was given the assignment, I would never cross too many lines. I would write the best story that I could. I would still keep him Superman. But for me, I'm just going to write my own shit.
Yeah.
My own characters. Because it's some things are just too, it's disingenuous. I can't write from a truly honest place.
Yeah. Yeah.
When
you're handcuffed, when you have any type of handcuffs creatively,
right.
it's hard. So, and that is the joy of true independent comics, and, you know, doing something like you do, where you can do anything you want, you know. So what was the path that led you to doing Ravenous? Like, what got you, like, how long, when did you start? How long did it get you to, you know, take you, and why? What was the impetus that made you go, like, you know what, I'm going to do it?
I had planned to do it after I finished college, after I got out of the military. I graduated. I finished college up in, was around 2012. And I was working on another project. And, you know, things happen. And so I had to fast track Ravenous. And that was in October of 2014. And the thing with that, these, I had to build an entire world. I had to ask questions. I had been working on the updated character design, because what I did at 12 wasn't going to work. So I had to so I had to design the character. I had to write the cast, come up with the cast, and figure out how to plug all these things in. And I had to figure out why this character gets up in the morning.
Yeah.
And I was like, so it started, I was like, okay, he does bad things to really bad people. Why? Right?
Yeah.
So that was the first question I had to answer. And I had to, you know, because before that I had been studying, taking a lot of writing courses, and building up my skills. And so by the time I got to that, I was ready. And but building his world was extremely difficult. It was extremely difficult. And I wasn't quite finished until around 2016. And one of the things that I decided was that his stories would no longer take place on Earth. I was like, it has to be another galaxy, and it has to be another planet, because I didn't want to have to deal with whatever bullshit that's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to be tied down and shackled to that.
Earth constraints. You can do anything when you're on another planet, you know?
Right. And, you know, from my point of thinking, I was like, I can, you know, people, they're still going to be greedy, petty, self-serving, all of these things. So the other thing, I served in the military for two wars, three actually. So I met a lot of people. I've seen a lot of bad things. I've seen a lot of evil, right? So I knew how to write evil from a real perspective.
Yeah.
Right. And some things had to be, you know, modified a little bit where people can handle it. Because that was the other thing I had to learn too, what people could handle and what they couldn't. Because I think the last part of training and writing, I still train and take a few workshops or classes. I did one at a UCLA Extension, and you had to come up with these stories, and you had to come up with three. And I didn't give them ravenous. I wrote other things. And that's when I found out got a barometer of what people could handle.
Yeah.
And what they couldn't. And so seeing real evil, I was like, yeah, this is the guy to do it. You know, these are things that Superman wouldn't handle, Batman wouldn't touch. None of these guys, I said, they wouldn't handle these situations properly. And the other thing was his teammates, or the other characters, when I make my characters, they're three people made into one, right? And some of them are military guys that I met.
Mm-hmm.
Some are here and some are no longer here. I was like, yeah, this is the guy. I said, this is why he has to be so brutal. This is why he does what he does, because if he's like this at this level, then the evil is up here.
Yeah.
Right. And he can meet them where they're at. Right. So that was the start. And there were a lot of rewrites.
It happens.
Yeah, there were a lot of rewrites. I really wanted to emphasize the brutality of his physical confrontations, but one component that I have now as an adult that I didn't when I was a kid is the mental aspect. You know, not only what type of person you have to be to do this type of work, but what are the moral injuries of doing this type of work, right? And so, yeah, Ravenous, he has a lot of power.
Yeah.
He's very strong. However, with that said, you can't muscle your way out of the mental stuff.
Right, yeah.
You know, that sticks with you. When you have to make a compromising moral decision, how does that affect you?
Yeah.
And so the issues on, these are the things that I start to show him dealing with, you know, the mental anguish. And, you know, a lot of people don't like to talk about this, but, you know, the suicide rate among, you know, people who fight in wars.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? It's crazy.
Yeah. So
let's say 1 in 4.
Yeah.
Oh, more than 1 in 4. Something. I think someone said even it's like maybe closer to 1 in 3 now. Even it's pretty high.
It's pretty high. And so for my take on it, again, trying to keep it a little bit more palatable, I like the book dark, but I like to leave some hope.
Yeah.
Right. So dealing with the suicide aspect and why, and that's the other thing, as dark as Ravenous is, he's the most positive one.
Yeah.
Which is a difficult task to do. One of the other things too is, you know, is there, you know, somebody that powerful, why does he cover his face? And, you know, I'd say one thing that Christopher Nolan got right with Batman, he's like, yeah, to protect the people that you care about. Mm-hmm. But imagine if you're SF guy or Delta and the Taliban, they know where you live.
Yeah.
They know your face. You know, that's a bad day, and you killed a bunch of their people.
Yeah.
Right. That's no good.
Yeah.
And that's the place where I take that from. It's just like, man, you can't be all over social media and have your face everywhere when you've done all of that.
Yeah. they'll come knocking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the kind of the darker side of it and how to make it palatable for people. I was before we hopped on today. I was over at a friend's house, artist working on something, and he's got a story he's working on, and he's kind of trying to find some inspiration. He's a little worried it was a little too dark, and and I told him, I'm like, hey man, I always use like Clockwork Orange as my metric for storytelling, because not only am I a huge Stanley Kubrick fan, but I also, you know, Anthony Burgess wrote the book. It's a fantastic book. The movie's killer. But it's one of those films where people can watch it, and if you're just watching it on the surface, it can seem distasteful and it can seem hard to watch, and you're not understanding the violence. You're not understanding the sexual violence. You're like, why is this? I'm just watching this like near porn thing. What was happening? But when you really start dissecting it and watching it, you're like, oh no, this movie was based on a book by an author whose wife was sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And he, having to deal with that trauma with her, looked at society and the decay of civilization and the decay of decency and the desensitization of the youth. And he extrapolated that into an extreme scenario and to this dystopian future and created a very dark vision as a warning. And that is how art works. And you know, if you can look at it on the surface, you can look at it as like art and understand what we're looking at. And we're looking at this, it's not just violence for violence sake, it's violence as a cautionary tale. It's violence to tell you what is happening as in today's culture. So like I like the, you know, not everything is ends with a happy ending and a, you know, in Tinkerbell. It's like we've got it. You gotta understand, like, this does tell a story, and I like the telling stories that way, and I think it's necessary for people to get that kind of shot of reality and like this is the darkness, this is in us, it's okay, this is what's happening from it, you know.
Yeah, there's no way that I could write any of the stories that I write not having the life experience as a man. There's absolutely no way. Yeah. There's no way. I always write from a place of pain and scars and everything. It keeps me honest. And I think it, people can tell.
Yeah.
People can tell. Yeah. They, you know, if your stories are not honest or you're not coming from a real place, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. I don't want what happened, well, let's say like a book like Spawn to happen to Ravenous. And that keeps me up at night, Deeks. It's like I have to write honest. I have to put these characters through it, whether it's physically or mentally or both. I have to talk about the hard stuff. I have to touch upon that any war is bad. Yeah, it can look fun, but what are the consequences of it? Right? And that's the place I come from, you know, with the story. It's like, yeah, he's very powerful. But it's one of those things, it's like, okay, when your people are mentally beat down, and they have no hope, they don't have the will to fight, how do you handle that, you know?
Yeah.
So I, when I created the planet Sparthos, before they were defeated in a war by another enemy from somewhere else, I was like, man, the place I came from, that I was like, what if China and Russia actually defeated the United States?
Yeah.
And everything that we know was gone. I had to take it from a place and say, well, David, imagine you go somewhere else and you come back to America and it's no longer the place that you recognize. There is no freedom anywhere on the planet. What does that look like? And any American that, or Canadian or Brit that dissents, they get put into a prison camp or they're killed. And for me, Sparthos, they were that shining light in the galaxy before they defeated. They took care of all the bad shit, all the people. Yeah, there's corruption just like anywhere else. And that's, you know, and they fell. But for me, it was like, how would you give a superpower, a godlike person, trauma and PTSD.
Yeah.
What does that look like? What does that look like? How do you break them? What is the extreme? Oh, I came up with the answer. But it's like how do you rip these people apart and then build them back up?
Right. Yeah.
Right. So that's the underlying themes of the entire book. And I hope people dig it.
Right. Yeah. Real quickly, what's the give us the, because I mean we talked a lot about the book, but what is like an elevator pitch? Your for people who don't know, what's your?
Ravenous is a book about a immortal soldier who returns to his home planet 27 years later to find that it's conquered by an invading force from another galaxy. And he will do anything by any means necessary to free his planet and the rest of the galaxy.
All right. There you go. And so people know, you wrote, created, drew, and then your wife does the color.
Digital painting. Yes. Painting,
correct. Great. And number one is out now. Number two is... Is number two out yet? Did you have?
Number two will be going to the printer at the end of the month.
Okay. And then let people know where can they find the book if they want to order it? Where can they find you, follow, and any updates for what's going on?
You can follow me at on Instagram at Ravenous. You can also check for updates at www.ravenous.net. And you could also find the book at Tribe Comics in Austin and hopefully some other comic book stores soon.
Coming soon for sure. So all right, well guys, follow David, follow the book, get a copy of the book, get a catch up before you read number two. I've read it. It's fantastic. So make sure you check it out. Also, if you're not in around Austin, Texas, you can go pick up a copy physically. We got mail, baby. They'll just ship you one, I'm sure. So get
absolutely,
make it happen and get caught up. David, anything else before we get out of here today?
No, it was a great time.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thank you. So, all right, guys. Well, we are going to get out of here for the week. Come back next week. We got a bunch of great guests lined up for 2025. So we're excited to bring it to you, a brand new year. And go to deescomedy.com. Check out live dates and go to inferno.earth. Check out the comic book Kill Stan. And that's it, guys, for the Social Hour. I've been Deese, and for David, thank you all very much. And we will see you all next week.